Sylvia Sachs with Natalie Apple interviewing Dr. Irving Wunder at his home on March 17, 1996.
Okay.
This is the Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. I am Sylvia Sachs with Natalie Apple interviewing Dr. Irving Wunder at his home on March 17, 1996. This is the second tape of the interview. Dr. Wunder, would you repeat for our records the names and ages of your children so that we have it down for you? I'm Sylvia Sachs with Natalie Apple interviewing Dr. Irving Wunder at his home on March
17,
1996.
Okay.
This is the Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral 52. I am Sylvia Sachs with Natalie Apple interviewing Dr. Irving Wunder at his home on March 17, 1996. This is the second tape of the interview. Dr. Wunder, would you repeat for our records the names and ages of your children so that we have it down for sure?
We unexpectedly had twin boys. My wife gained all of 11 pounds, and the boys weighed 11 pounds. And the first one was Edward Lawrence Wunder, and the other twin was Donald Bruce Wunder.
And when were they born?
1950, April 7th. Good Friday, a four
April 7th, 1950. Okay, and then
and the third was Richard Charles, and he was born September 25th, 1953. And he was supposed to be a girl, but he was not.
And I know that we have your wife's maiden name here somewhere, but let's repeat it just for sure.
Her name was Rhea, R-E-A-H, Margolin, M-A-R-G-O-L-I-N.
And she was born in
Chattanooga, Tennessee.
In our last interview, we talked about your career as a petroleum engineer.
I was really a chemist.
Chemical engineer.
I'm a chemist who is working in the chemical engineering department. But I did teach in the chemistry department during the year.
At the University of Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Before we move on to more personal things, I thought I would ask you how you view your profession or the chemical industry, whatever. Is there a future? I mean, are we going to run out of these like petroleum and, you know, what is your view of the future?
You ask a question of if there is much hullabaloo. By the way, did I tell you that I graduated from City College of New York?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which has no tuition. And that's the only way I could have gone to school.
I believe
you did. Under those
circumstances,
yes. The present situation is a very odd one. We do import more than half of all oil. And that is rising to a place where it would be costing us close to $100 billion a year to pay for that oil, which affects our...
$100 billion.
And that affects our balance of payments and deficits and all that. And of course, most of the oil is in areas that are precarious, like Saudi Arabia, Israel, for some reason, has absolutely no oil. We fought the desert war, of course, only because when oil was called the oil war. If there were no oil there, we would never have been in it over there. And when I was in Hungary, there was a cartoon of two men standing in Bosnia, back to back, and one man saying, "I smell smoke," and the other man saying, "But I don't think it's oil burning." And we never went there, really. So oil, nevertheless, will last quite a while. But the big thing that's come on lately is the discovery of huge amounts of natural gas all over the world. It's much cleaner than either petroleum or coal. Coal has gone down, although we use over 1 billion tons of coal a year, and more than half of our electricity still comes to this day from coal. But this administration, far as they're concerned, would like coal to just disappear.
Do you see something else coming up to replace? For instance, you said gas, but could you run a car on gas? Natural gas?
People, those trucks that deliver to the department have run on gas, but you can't go very far. I do not see, by the time I have cars being run on natural gas. There's a time to do that. But they have been adding replacing lead, you know, lead is kind of bad for you. There's different kinds of chemicals to make the lead out, keep the oxygen up, you know. But it's a continuing sort of fight going on around the world. The big thing that's going on, we talk about energy, is electric power.
That something has to be used, some fuel has to be used
to make. Talking to a man, you know, we have controls on electric power units to cut down emissions. But in China, the electricity need is fantastic. And this country has been building electricity generating units as fast as it can possibly can in China with no controls whatsoever. Chinese don't care, they just want the power. They don't care what the emissions are, so far.
So someday we're all going to suffer from that.
Well, the greenhouse effect is the one that gives you carbon dioxide, which is supposed to make the world warmer and warmer. Our efforts to control that in this country are really not meaningful, because of the third world, Chinese and Asia, who are building these plants and flooding the world with carbon dioxide, which is, you know, the chief cause of the greenhouse effect. The other chief cause of the greenhouse effect is simply what you are burning and running your car. But nobody will stop that. You can do anything to a person in this state, in this country, except to move or make it impossible for him to run his car. He will drop everything and fight. He'll have a war. We can have a war that everyone will support if you threaten the use of his car. Nobody wants to cut down on the use of gasoline, which is a large cause in our state. You never hear that.
because it affects his son. The energy situation is a flexible one. We will use coal and gas and petroleum probably for another 50, 60 years, but the supplies that will not run out for hundreds of years are supplies of coal. So we will always have that. At the moment, we're still using a lot of coal. China uses more than we do. So it's a politically tough situation, especially with oil. We have all the energy we want, super energy, except for one thing, transportation. That's why we import oil. And the main reason we import oil is to run our trucks, not to make electricity. We can do that without help. That's an issue that nobody really addresses, but we know we'll fight like that for oil because we want to.
Okay. I wondered what your view of the future is. Now, if it's okay with you, can we move on to one of your outside activities, which was working with young people at Red Oak Shoal and Temple?
Right.
How did that start?
We joined the show as soon as the boys were shortly after we were born. And the boys were confirmed, of course, and they were active in the youth group, PAFTI.
What is it?
PAFTI.
Pennsylvania Association, Federation of Temple Youth.
Yeah. One of the boys, two of the boys, I'm sure, were headed by the classes here. And then all three became Eagle Scouts at the temple. Stanley Arnheim was the scoutmaster, and for a while I was the assistant scoutmaster. And then when Stanley left, I stayed on for quite a long time. Went to summer camp with them.
What years would that have been?
I wish Leah were down here. She knows better than I. Well, I can tell you. 1961 to 1970.
And was this the typical scout group where you learned how to tie knots and you went? That sort of thing, or what type of a scout?
It was an outstanding
due to fine leadership.
That's right. Well, Stanley Arnheim was
and Stuart was involved too.
Stewie was a young person. He was just sort of coming along. He did not take over. He was succeeded by a fellow named a young man, David Hughes, on the lead, who was not Jewish, but was a member of Brotherhood. His wife was Jewish.
There are certain Orthodox Jews who say people who belong to Temple are not Jews. We won't get into that. I just read an article with that effect. Okay.
Pardon me, David, who are you with?
Yeah. Then, of course, I was a member of Brotherhood.
A member of what?
Brotherhood. And at that time, someone, I don't think it was I, who said perhaps it was during the 60s, and things were quite rough out there, for young children. In fact, Judy was among the youth at that time, and he made the suggestion that we should start some sort of, I don't think he called it coffee house, but some sort of way of getting them together and making an avenue of which they could express themselves. And he suggested, I remember the meeting quite well, he said we devote one classroom to a meeting once a week. And I thought of that and said that a classroom is absolutely the wrong place people can't make conversations. That's what a classroom is, and they had enough of that. And I thought we should have something that was anything but. And down in the basement of the building, there was a room that I think had storage pieces in there. And we ended up going down there and clearing it out. And we ended up calling it the exit. You know, sort of, so it was called the exit. In fact, I have an entry card in my desk. And we had it on Friday night for high school students. And about a year later, some came in on Saturday night for college students. And I was lucky enough to, at least a year or two, to get a young couple to help out. Because a lot of kids came. And the thing we would serve donuts, and I always managed to pay somebody $5 to handle that. I mean, the fellow who gives the weather on one of the stations. Was one of them. And then Judy Cohn was put down there regularly. And a lot of kids, I have to admit, were sitting around the corner, semi-stoned. But
you mean outside?
No, inside. And I was worried at the time because things were a little rough. And so there was a Reverend Mowry, M-O-W-R-Y, who had started some coffee house. I went to see him. And so we talked for a while.
Excuse me, what nomination would he have been?
He probably, I don't think he was Catholic.
He
said the main danger, of course, in which I could see, because people started to come who were not Jewish, was some black another gang or somebody comes to him and makes a sound. And his advice was that when and if, and it was likely to happen, by all means, invite them in, offer them coffee or Coke or donuts, and try not to be frightened. And it did happen just as he said. Once or twice, one day particularly, a really rough bunch of guys showed up. A little older than the kids who were here.
What was their, did they come to make trouble or?
Well, that was the point. Once they got in, they were out of place. They were not Jewish. They were older. They all wore the black leather jackets at that time. They were not the kind of people that we wanted. Well, I did just what he said. I said, come on in, have a donut, welcome, and all that sort of stuff.
Were you the only adult there at the time?
Well, there was no adult. I think there may have been some adult, but I was the one who met them.
Mm.
And to my surprise, when I said that, they would not cross the door, the threshold. They just would not. They would put a foot inside.
Hmm.
And they left. And just, I was awfully glad I had talked to them. But it continued, and there was really no formal program. The room was downstairs. Some, again, you may remember the name of the person, some person at Rota said he would donate some sum, $5,000 or more, if we would name the place. Put up hot with his name on it.
Hmm.
And I turned it down. I said, that wasn't the type of place where that belonged. We didn't want any...
Anti-establishment.
Right, it was anti-establishment that would be perceived as such. And so we turned it down. One of the few times that somebody turned money down.
Yeah, that's, I think that would be ego. How long did this coffee house exist?
About five years.
Is that once a week? So
every Friday and every Saturday. And during the summer, I tell you what happened during the summer. And why we closed. During the summers, I wanted some. There were a lot of kids around who needed someplace to go, and I wanted something entertaining. It was different. And one of my friends, Dan, and anyway, she's part of the community college about biology. And I asked her if she would come down and talk to the children about it. Well, call it sex if you want, but mainly interaction with the other sex. And she agreed, and then I found out that she taught anatomy, and she was going to give them a course in anatomy. So I turned that down. But I found a professor at Pitt who drew hundreds of his college students to lecture, and was Jewish, and I asked him if he would come at least once a week to the coffee house and do whatever he would. Well, he agreed, and that was a wonderful, interesting summer, because more and more kids came down. And he would do, he would show two movies at the same time, at different points. And at the same time, he would have music, right? And everyone would be entranced. What he would usually, one time, one of the walls decorated with a design or circular thing. Couldn't see it very much. And he showed the movie right on there, so you couldn't quite see it. And that was really almost a pornographic movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the other one, he showed Life of the Gorillas. And with the music going on. And after it was over, one girl said, I couldn't see that movie because of the design on the wall. He said, all you have to do with that, I'm going to change it. Another
who
time,
was this professor?
I can't remember his name. He sent his breath. Maybe we didn't remember last year, but I don't know. One time, when Leah and Mrs. Feldman were coming down, he asked them if they would cover their heads with a bit large paper bag with just eyes. And they did. And they sat there. And the result was really remarkable. While kids who were there wouldn't really speak to adults very easily, they crowded around these women with their bags over their heads, whom they could not see, these faces, and talk to them, told them their culture. Leah was one of them. And Mrs. Hellman wrote them, wrote with the other. That was kind of an interesting experience. He was a marvelous guy to have, and the summer got to be very popular.
What's the point of this, to get these young people to unburden themselves and to talk about the...
No, not really.
It was just a place
to stay that was decent, where they could, in a way, express themselves. We had no formal program. And what would happen every time, somebody would get up and bring a guitar and play, somebody would sing, somebody would, it just never failed, and I was amazed at how that happened. There was always a program of some kind, and people were kind of anxious to do their thing. And the coveted thing was the person who handled the donuts and stuff, and got paid $5. That was a job that everybody wanted. I don't know why, but it. So, one, I can tell you this much. Several of the kids who sat around were on to something. I don't know what kind of drug or whatever, but they would sit sort of stoned around. And we would try to talk to them. But I think the main purpose of it was to put them in an atmosphere where they felt comfortable, at home, and not, at the time, it's hard to imagine today how difficult the times were for children in the 60s. And they felt comfortable down here because they came, and they'll get them home. And the Saturday one, where college students came, also was quite well attended. I remember going over and asking one young man why he had come down, and he turned out to be a faculty member, a young faculty member.
So it was a place to have social contacts and
do, but it wasn't forced upon anybody. I mean, they could talk to whoever they want, and they felt comfortable because they came back. It wasn't classroom style. There was no teacher. Things that went on. My own boys, one of my boys, very musical, and he came down to a place. My own boys did not, in the way they did not come down to school. I, on the other hand, made it a point to come. They were dressed any way you could think. I made it a point to come down with a shirt and tie and jacket. I could be easily differentiated by anybody who was there. And I always came down there. But we had to close. We had to close because the time went on as long as like last year, the 50s. Things changed, and I noticed that different people were coming. I noticed that liquor was suddenly withdrawn. And I would go into the bathroom and find smashed bottles of liquor in the toilet, and not things were getting a little out of hand. So it ended when I asked a young lady who was a psychiatrist to come down. She brought her daughter, who was in her 18, and tell me what to do. Things are changing, and the place is getting rather rough. And in fact, it's being invaded, I think, by more and more by children, not by kids who are not Jewish. But she came down. She spent an evening there. And at the end of the evening, she said, close this place up. It's out of hand. And so we did. And at the end of the evening.
So you never had fight training, but it was just a feeling that it was getting out of hand.
At the end, it was, yeah. We never had a fight. Then after that, to my surprise, I was, because of my activities in Scouts and Exit, I was asked to serve on the Board of Trustees, which I did for 2 years only. And I don't think you're exactly interested in what I resigned. You don't have to put this on tape. But Mr. Aaron.
Yeah. Did any of the rabbis participate in the exit?
Rabbi Jacob came down, and once in a while he would just come in and look around. And he was always welcomed by everybody. And Rabbi Pomerantz was particularly. He would come down, and even once in a while, he'd participate and he'd play something. But he was very, he played the drums and was in a band and very musical.
cuff. I didn't realize he was in the band.
And, oh, yes, in fact, he's come back to Pittsburgh, and Gail Hunter has been up to that. We got to be very friendly with him. The board did not like that, I thought. For some reason, I don't know. And when he left, he was interviewed by Temple, New Jersey, which we were here, you know, the guy, Temple. And they were nice enough, when the people came to interview Rabbi Tarnak, to ask Rhea and me to attend the interview for the lunch, because we particularly found some food, a lot of food to talk about.
Mm-hmm.